Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your life connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Integrity in Action, live on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, monthly on the fourth Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. This is your opportunity to listen live with host Lois Shulman, empowerment coach, facilitator, and public speaker of Integrity in Action, LLC. She will interview with sensitivity, unconditional love, and without judgment individuals who have chosen to exemplify the highest levels of ethical principles, sound moral character, and honesty. Each month, a featured guest will share their story. These interviews will give listeners an opportunity to feel the passion and emotion of the person being interviewed, as well as inspire listeners to entertain new perspective from which to expand their own understanding. When this occurs, we move beyond the limitations of our current thinking to heal and become more aware, awake, and expansive. And now I give you your wonderful host, Lois Shulman.
Thank you. I'm honored to have as my guest Dr. Leonard Rosen. Dr. Rosen is the medical director at Oakland Community Health Network, whose office is in Auburn Hills, Michigan. Dr. Rosen is also the medical director for behavioral services at Henry Ford Wyandotte Hospital. Dr. Rosen is an active member of the Department of Community Health Clinical Advisory Committee, as well as a Department of Psychiatry faculty member at both Wayne State University and Michigan State University. The reason I'm taking a moment to share with you a very short list of Dr. Rosen's credentials is that he possesses the extraordinary gift of passion for community activism with years of acquired knowledge, wisdom, and experience in serving those seeking his guidance. Dr. Rosen, in my reading, I have come to understand that being truthful with oneself is really what matters. How does one aspire to this understanding?
Well, first of all, thank you for the very kind introduction. Something my mother might have heard, so I'm impressed. But I always want to begin by saying that I have been very fortunate in my life in that I became a physician and a psychiatrist, and I've had the opportunity in my professional life to experience so many wonderful things. And It's always a wonderful opportunity when I can talk about some of the good things that have happened along the way in my career as a psychiatrist. And as I think back from my relatively humble beginnings, both of my parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. They were relatively uneducated, coming from extreme poverty, and coming to this country in the 1920s. And rebuilding their lives, and one of their goals was to make sure that their children were educated. It was very important to go to school to learn and to make a mark on the world. So I've been blessed with the opportunity, had the support, tremendous support of parents who encouraged me along the way, and I ended up in medical school and then in psychiatry, and it's been a fascinating journey for me, because I never imagined along the way that I would ever reach this point of being medical director of a large community mental health agency that serves thousands of people every year. And to think that I'm playing a small part in helping that happen is very gratifying. So I guess one of the things I can talk about is how I, as a physician and a psychiatrist, reach out to people and help them understand, in the process, hopefully help them feel better, function better, and contribute to the world around them, to the community, in the ways that they want to, in the way they can, help maximize the potential for their lives. So I always begin with the notion or the idea of stress. And so what is stress? Stress is the demands that the environment places on all of us. Stress is an inevitable part of life. We can't escape stress. And when you think about life from its very beginnings, when the baby pops out of the womb, what's the first thing baby does? Baby screams and cries because, gee, what is this? It's cold and it's dark or it's light and I want to go back in the womb. and but maybe has to face the real world, all of the challenges that come along the way. I have to walk, and I have to talk, and I have to use the phone, and I have to go to school, kindergarten, and then I have to make friends, and I have to behave myself, and I have to go to college, and I have to find a partner, and I have to have a career, and every step of life is stressful. And when you reach midlife, and you lose your job, you have to move in a different direction, divorce, your parents pass away, all these very stressful things. And then you reach the senior years of life where you have to face retirement and the likelihood of disabling illnesses. And so the capacity for human beings to survive, to go on, and to flourish with all of these stresses is amazing. I mean, how do we do it? And because the fact is that most of us do survive these stresses. But if stress rises to the point where I would call it distress, then we're in trouble. Because when we're in a distressful state, we're feeling overwhelmed by the things happening around us. And we begin to think, you know, I can't do it. It's more than I can handle. And so distress, I like to divide distress into three general categories. So there's mental stress, there's physical stress, and there's behavioral stress. So mental stress, what is that? So there's really maybe four different ways I conceptualize this. Under mental distress, we can become fearful, call it anxiety, frightened, or we can become sad, feel hopeless, we call that depression, or we can become hyper and restless, psychiatrists call that mania, or we can become mistrustful, suspicious, call that paranoia. And all of those emotional states, those distressful states, get in the way of us being able to enjoy life and being able to accomplish the things that we're all capable of accomplishing. So there's the distress that comes, that's physical. So what happens to us when we experience physical distress? Well, any and every part of the body can be impacted, from headaches to dizziness to burning stomachs to backache to insomnia. So our bodies don't work well when we're in that distressful state. And then there's what I call the behavioral reactions to distress. And so we start doing things that we shouldn't be doing, like overeating or undereating or smoking or drinking or taking too many pain pills or acting out in aggressive, mean, hostile ways or withdrawing from the world. And so this distressful state affects our mind, our bodies, and our behaviors. And so how do we deal with that? Well, the stress is, as we all know, is a part of life. And there's something called the stress response, and everybody knows about it, read about it, but everybody knows about it. It's called the fight or flight response. So that if I'm walking down a dark street in a neighborhood I don't know, maybe not the best of neighborhoods, and I see somebody across the street and it looks like he might have a gun, well, I am going to have a fight or flight response. My body, my brain, and my body will make stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline. And all of that's very adaptive because it protects me, because the cortisol increases my blood sugar and the adrenaline speeds up my heart and breathing so that I can get the sugar to my cells so I can either fight or run away and save my life. So that's an adaptive response, that stress response. There's a reason for it. Literally saves our lives. And we all hear these stories of like a little kid gets stuck under the car and mother's able to lift up the car and pull her baby to safety. It's because she's had this massive outpouring of stress hormones that give her the strength at that moment to do almost the impossible, and she saves her baby's life. But what happens when the stress response doesn't turn off? And so think about a middle-aged man working at an auto plant on the assembly line. And he has a really tough supervisor boss who's coming by every 20 minutes and saying, speed it up, speed it up. If you don't do your job right, every one of you on this line is going to lose their job because we're going to send the job to China. And so every half hour, this supervisor comes by, and this poor guy is just so angry and frustrated. He's working as hard as he can. He doesn't have control over the global economy and whether China will take the job. He's doing the best he can, and he's got this supervisor's harassing him. And this poor guy is so angry, and the anger doesn't go away. But what does happen is that he is constantly making cortisol and adrenaline. And so what does that do to him? Well, we know that too much cortisol increases blood sugar, so you predispose yourself to diabetes. Too much cortisol irritates the stomach lining, so you get a bleeding ulcer. Too much cortisol makes brain cells shrink so that you don't think as well. Predispose yourself to Alzheimer's disease. And your immune system doesn't work as well. Cortisol, too much, turns off those antibody cells that gobble up bacteria and viruses and cancer cells and enable us to stay healthy. And the increased adrenaline, it's there all the time, means your heart's beating too fast, and your blood pressure's too high, and that leads to premature heart disease and strokes. People die much younger than they need to. So, question I have to deal with this. I'm trying to help people who come to me, typically in this distress state, is what are the strategies that will help somebody prevent stress from becoming distress? And some of the answers to that question are really common sense. You don't have to read textbooks. You don't have to go to medical school. Human beings are able to think in pretty rational ways. But, you know, they're the same that common sense isn't always that common. So at the top of the list is having to set priorities, because we all have 1,000 things to do each day. Maybe in the old days when we lived on a farm and life was much simpler, and we, you know, the seasons dictated what we were doing, and when it was harvest time, we were real busy, but then when winter came, you could rest. But we're now on a 24-hour cycle with emails. You go on vacation, come back to work, and it's 4,000 emails because you don't turn off your emails when you're on vacation. So that we're probably more stressed today than we were in the past, even though we've advanced with our technology. But to survive, you have to set priorities. And so there are 1,000 things to do, but what are the 3 or 4 most important things to do? And that's what I'm going to do today, so that by the end of the day, when I go to sleep and I'm tired, and I can say I've accomplished X, Y, and Z, rather than going to bed saying, oh, look at all the things I haven't done. So setting priorities is crucial. But the other thing is maintaining a normal routine. Because what happens when we're overly stressed is we tend to stop doing the healthy things we're doing, whether it's taking time to take time out for lunch. I'm not going to walk this evening after work. I'm not going to take that exercise class. I'm too busy. And so you end up giving up the healthy things that really protect you from becoming distressed. So I always remember when I was reading autobiography of Lee Iacocca, who was, you know, the CEO of Chrysler Corporation years ago, when the company was in big trouble. They were about to go bankrupt. And Iacocca was having to travel to Washington to convince President Nixon to give them a loan or bail them out. And literally the jobs of thousands of people were in the hands of Lee Iacocca, because if he made the wrong decisions, all these people were going to lose their job. And on top of that, his wife was dying of cancer. And they asked him, how in the world can you possibly not be overwhelmed by all this? And he said, I always took an hour off for lunch, short of some cataclysmic emergency. I always took that hour for lunch. I turned off the phone. I made sure that I had lunch with a friend, a colleague, somebody I wanted to be with, wasn't business. It wasn't work. It was relaxation. And that was what he felt helped him get through that very difficult time. So there's another concept called cognitive reframing. And so it's sort of like, is the glass half full or glass half empty? It's always better to say the glass is half full. Is it partly cloudy or is it partly sunny? It's much better to just say it's sunny. So, you know, stressful things happen. Somebody might find out they're being laid off from the job. And, of course, that's got to be very upsetting. My finances are sitting out to pay the mortgage. And you could say, well, this is a catastrophe, and it's all over. Or you can say, you know, I never really liked that job. This is an opportunity for me to go back to school and to do what I really want to do and turn my life around. So turning a potential catastrophe into a moment of growth and moving into something that's much better for me. So the other important way, the other important strategy for preventing stress becoming distress is to share your frustrations with others. Don't keep it bottled up. Very often when we're feeling overwhelmed, we're ashamed, we're embarrassed. I'm not supposed to feel this way. I'm supposed to be strong and tough. And so you pretend everything's okay. That's not a good strategy. It's very helpful to have somebody, one or two or three people, who you can unburden yourself to. That other person may not have any great answers, but just being able to share with somebody else what you're going through diffuses the situation, reduces the tension inside. And so it's like, you know, having a good cry doesn't change the world, but you feel a whole lot better. It's as if, you know, the bottle is filling up to the top, and if you don't let it out, the bottle's going to crack. It's going to explode. So it's helpful to let that out. The technical term we use is catharsis, getting it out. And another very important way of reducing stress is laughter, to be able to joke, to be able to put a smile on your face. One of the reasons why comedians are very important people. We need to be able to laugh. And when we reach a point where we can't laugh, we're in trouble. And then finally, the concept of altruism, that is, reaching out to others. If you can be doing something that you know is helping somebody else, that is a tremendous stress reducer. Human beings feel good when they help others. We are social creatures. We care about each other. And when we know that we're doing something for someone else, that's really helping them, we're also helping ourselves. We build our self-esteem. And we put things in perspective, because very often we begin to see, gee, look at what this guy has to go through. What I have to go through is nothing compared to what he's going through. So those are the important strategies that I use in helping people who come to me in a distressful state. Now, the other important concept is resilience. So what is resilience? We know that there are resilient people, people who go through horrendous things, people who survive concentration camps and torture, imprisonment. I'm thinking about Senator McCain, who was in a North Vietnamese prison camp for 5 years. His plane was shot down in Vietnam. He not only survived it, but he became a senator. So what is resilience? And the definition I really like, resilience, is it's the emotional muscle that we're capable of strengthening. You can think of resilience as a muscle, just the way the biceps is a muscle. And if you exercise, if you lift a weight, that biceps will get bigger. It gets stronger. It has to. There's a signal that goes up to your brain that says, this muscle's hurting, and the signal goes down, and you grow muscle. And it has to happen. Our bodies are built to do that. Well, we can build our resilience by engaging in those positive strategies that help us feel stronger and feel more capable of dealing with whatever is happening. So, yes, today is bad, but I have my family. I have my support system. I'm going to get through this. I have to get through it because I have things to accomplish. And being able to say that to yourself, you build that emotional muscle. So it's, you know, when people are having a hard time and they're getting real depressed, and I say to them, you know, I know you don't feel like getting up and doing anything. I know you get up in the morning, you're feeling horrible, and you just want to get back in bed and pull the covers over your head. And what I say to that person is that it would be much better, even though you don't feel like doing this, is to get up, get dressed, go out, and visit a friend or visit a neighbor and put a smile on your face, even though you don't feel like it. Because when you put that smile on your face, you send a signal to the pleasure centers in your brain. And your brain says, wait a second, things can't possibly be that bad. She's smiling, she's got a dress, she's going out, she's doing things. That's a mental exercise, just like lifting a weight. Increase your bicep muscle, putting that smile on your face, going out into the world and doing something is sending a signal to the pleasure centers of your brain, and that part of your brain grows. So what's one of the things that's been most rewarding to me as a psychiatrist, as I've been, I'm not 20 years old anymore, I've been around for a while, but we have made such tremendous gains and our understanding of the brain and the body, the interconnections, how things really work. So 10 or 20 years ago, I couldn't tell somebody, you know, you can exercise your brain as well, because in medical school, I was taught that you're born with all the brain cells you'll ever have, and you start losing them by the time you're 20, and that's just downhill course. Well, now with these wonderful imaging techniques, brain scans and CAT scans, we can see that parts of the brain are able to grow. And so when that person puts a smile on his face, stimulates the pleasure center in the brain, that part of the brain lights up. It starts to grow. You can grow new brain cells. You can grow new connections. So that the human body and the brain are a fascinating organism. It's a self-healing, replicating, I don't want to call it a machine, because that does a injustice to our brain and our body. But think about our brain. So it's the size of a fist, a little bigger than a fist. But there's like 40 billion neurons. Each time I read about it, they say there's another 10 billion. So 40 billion less than that. Each of those neurons, brain cells, is connected to dozens of others. So there's trillions of what's called synapses. If you were to line up all of those strands of neurons in the brain, they would go around the world four times. 100,000 miles. And to think of the capacity of that brain and what it does and how much more it can do if we treat it. So when you put that smile on your face, even though you just found out you're not going to get a bonus this year, your pay is going to be cut, putting that smile on your face grows that pleasure center in your brain and turns off the worry center. So the other wonderful thing that we've learned, really been very inspiring to me, is to know that dealing with the emotional side of health is very important. That when we are not well emotionally, when we're under too much stress, our bodies also don't work well. So that when you're depressed, you're much more likely to get pneumonia, you're much more likely to get a bleeding ulcer. The two go, emotional health and physical health go together. And, you know, just a couple of years ago, the World Health Organization reported that the most frequent cause of disability in the world today is not heart disease and not cancer, but depression. That more people are disabled by depression than those other, quote, physical illnesses. So this is very important information, because it means that it is very important that we work on helping people learn to deal with stress in more effective ways, because we help them prevent from developing serious mental illness and serious physical illness.
So there are lots of different ways to do that, lots of different theories out there. So is there one particular way that you use if someone sitting in front of you is not doesn't have any hope of ever feeling.
So, you know, there are many very wise people who've written books and articles, in scholarly journals, professors, lay people. There's all these theories about what helps people. And I take what I call a very eclectic approach. I want to figure out what will work for this person who's in front of me. And so I try one approach and see if that's helping, and we move that way. But if it's not helping, I try another approach so that I'm insight-oriented, psychoanalytic therapies, where you try to help a person understand the sources of their anxiety, that they may go back to childhood experiences, to traumas in the past. And you help them understand that the way they're feeling today is really a reaction to things that happened a long time ago. And sometimes gaining that insight can be very helpful, so that somebody who was traumatized by their father because he was violent or sexually abusive, and now as an adult, that person has great difficulty relating to men. And to help them understand that you don't have to be afraid of men because they're not going to be like your father. And having that understanding helps a person move forward in their life. So that approach can be helpful for some people, but there are other people who benefit from cognitive behavioral therapy. We talked about cognitive reframing, helping people learn to say the right things to themselves. Even though you might feel horrible today, feel very depressed today, you don't have to act. You don't have to act as if you're depressed. You can say, I am in control of what I do, and I'm certainly in control of what I say to myself. So I may wake up this morning and feel horrible, and again, want to pull the covers over my head, but I can say to myself, I know that if I want to go forward in my life, I have to get up, and I can get up. And even though I'm not enjoying eating breakfast, I'm still going to eat breakfast, and I'm going to go out and look for a job because I was laid off 3 months ago, and I do need to find work. And if I lay in bed all day, I am not going to get back on track. I've got to have a job. And so that kind of approach, which we call cognitive behavioral therapy, is very helpful. Now, another very important approach that we've learned about in the last few years is something called motivational enhanced therapy. Many people are not motivated to get help. Many people deny that they're under stress. There's nothing wrong with me. Leave me alone. Not an unusual response. So how do you help somebody who doesn't want help? And this is where motivational therapies are extremely helpful, because it's a strategy to help someone move in the direction of getting help, even though at that moment in time they'll say they don't. So an example might be someone comes to see me because they have a drinking problem. And of course, you have a drinking problem. It spills over into other things. And, you know, he's telling me his wife is getting fed up with him. And she's going to leave him if he doesn't stop drinking, because when he comes home drunk, he can be pretty angry. And sometimes he's taking a swing at her. And she said she's not going to put up with him. He, in the course of telling me all of this, he's saying how much he loves his wife and his children, and he doesn't want to break up his family. But he's also telling me he can't stop drinking. So I would simply say to him, help me understand this. You tell me you love your wife and your family and you don't want to disrupt them. You're also telling me you can't stop drinking. Help me understand that. So that now I put the burden on him to explain what he has just said to me, because there's a big contradiction here. I love my wife and I don't want to lose her, but I'm going to continue drinking. You can't have both of those ideas going at the same time. Help me understand that. So that's a quick summary of how we try to motivate people to move in the right direction. So you can't stop drinking completely, but could you not come home intoxicated? So yeah, well, maybe you could have a couple drinks. I prefer you not drink at all, but coming home intoxicated puts you at great risk for behaving in very inappropriate ways that will jeopardize your marriage. So what are you willing to do? Because there is a reason why he's drinking. Maybe it's because the only time he feels comfortable is when he's has alcohol, but maybe he has excessive degree of anxiety, so he's medicating himself with alcohol. So we deal with what's causing you to be so anxious. Let's find a better solution to your anxiety, something other than ingesting alcohol.
So how do you help people that say that they hear, they're always talking in their head, like they always have these negative voices going on? They're so hypercritical. Is there a way that you give them to be able to quiet those voices? What is a technique that could be helpful?
So very important technique in helping people is listening to them and listening to, you know, what are the voices saying? What are the themes that are, there very often is a theme. There's an underlying message there. So the voice is saying, sounds like the voices are saying you're a bad person. You feel you're a bad, why do you feel you're a bad person? How do I help that? So that person may need a lot of help in raising their self-esteem. So how do you do that? And again, it gets to letting the person tell you their story, their life story, because human beings have tremendous strengths. And even on the surface, someone comes to me and says, well, about this person's life's been a train wreck. He's made so many mistakes. He's used such poor judgment. There can't possibly be anything positive that I could say to him. So it reminds me of, I was very young in training, and I was a resident at Sinai Hospital, and I was asked to see this gentleman who'd come into the emergency room, and he'd just been released from prison. He was a kind of a scary-looking guy, because he had been in prison for murder. For whatever reason, now he was out, and he was very depressed because, what am I going to do now? I don't have a job. I don't have any money. I've been alienated from everybody, and my life is hopeless. And I'm thinking, how in the world am I going to possibly help this guy who seems to have nothing going for him? He's a murderer. I mean, that's what I'm thinking initially, feeling very uncomfortable. But as he talks about, as I listen to him, tell me about your life. What was it like in prison? It was horrible, but you know what? I always remembered on my mother's birthday I called her. So I said to him, you know, you obviously loved your mother. And you obviously made some mistakes in prison. But you had a sense of caring, love, respect for your mother. That's something very special. Despite everything that happened, you made a point of calling your mother. It's a very simple little thing. I broke down in tears. As I remember it, I'm crying. Because it was something positive that I could say, I'm not such a horrible monster here. You know, I love my mother, so I made some mistakes here, but I'm not all evil. So, you know, there isn't a simple cookbook formula to help people. But what's helped me help people is listening to them and listening for their strengths, because everybody has something positive. So I'm thinking of a woman who, now this was very challenging. She was a social worker who came to me very depressed. And she had postpartum depression several years before she came to see me. And in that depression, she was thinking of ending her life. And she was saying to herself, in a kind of psychotic thinking, if I'm not going to be around, I can't abandon this baby, so I'm going to kill the baby too. Now, fortunately, she wasn't successful in killing the baby or herself. Felt horrible shame about this. And she's telling me this maybe 10 years later that she's coming to see me. And it turns out that she lost her mother when she was 10 years old. And life was not very good after that, because she was sent from one relative to another, never had a home, never felt loved. And the people who, this is her recollection, the people who raised her, aunts, uncles, distant relatives, said, you were such a mean kid, that's why your mother died so young. That was the image she had of herself. And, but as as she was able to talk about this, and I tried to help her understand that, number one, you had nothing to do with your mother's death. It was a tragedy that she died when you were only 10 years old. But it wasn't because you were a bad kid. And it's true that when you were profoundly depressed, you were suicidal and thought about killing your only child. But, of course, you didn't do that. And not only did you not hurt your child, because of how hurt you were when you lost your mother, you went out of your way to be a good mother to your daughter, and you made sure that she had the best education, even though you didn't have a lot of money and lived in the inner city. You made sure that your daughter went to a good school and that she did her homework. And now she's 20 years old and she's in college and doing well, and you can feel so proud of what you've done, so that you were hurt as a young child, but because of that hurt, it made you a much better mother, and you can be very proud of the accomplishments as you see your daughter moving forward in life. Now, what was amazing about this patient is that her daughter now is 20 years old, gets engaged, is getting married, and my patient invited me to the wedding.
Oh, how beautiful.
So this is in the inner city, Detroit, and my wife is afraid to go. It's a bad neighborhood. I said, well, I have to go. And I went. And it was in the inner city. It was a little scary, but I came into the church. It's a Baptist church, an African-American congregation. I was the only white person in the building, in the church. But my patient greeted me, and he sat at the back. I had this wonderful view as I watched the wedding. And I'm watching 20-year-old daughter walking down the aisle. And I know everything about this family because she's told me. I know that this daughter, they were supposed to not be here back when her mother had that postpartum depression. But to see where she has come and to be able for me to experience this was so gratifying. To be kind of selfish here, that I helped this woman overcome her depression. And she has rewarded me by inviting me to see the fruits of her labor. It was wonderful.
So when I'm listening to you, I'm thinking your resilience is being built up to be the best psychiatrist you can be by this repetitive positive.
And then she had a 65th birthday, and she had a family, and she invited all of her family. She was from the South. She invited the whole family. She invited me. And this time my wife came. And so I'm thinking, coming into this large hall that they rented for the party, and she told me there's going to be a lot of people there. I'm thinking, well, I have to maintain confidentiality. What am I going to say to people? I said, well, who are you? What are you doing here? And I'm like, I can't tell her I'm the psychiatrist. I'm thinking, well, what will I say? You know? But she solved the problem. As I came in the door, she grabbed me by the arm, took me on, introduced me to all of her family. I'd like you to meet my psychiatrist.
Oh, she was so proud of how far she had come.
So it was a wonderful experience. And again, one of the wonderful things about being a psychiatrist is you learn so much about people. But I knew everybody in that room because she had come to me for years, and she told me about that horrible sister who she hated, and that uncle who was a no-good so-and-so. And here she was introducing me to them and shaking my hand. But the bottom line here is that helping people, number one, you can help people. There isn't one magic formula. What underlies it all is getting to know that person. And once you get to know somebody, together you can figure out strategies that will help improve the quality of their lives. And that's true for anyone, despite whatever is going on. So, I see people at all stages of life. I'm an adult psychiatrist, so I tend not to see children, but I see elderly people, and I see people in the last phase of life. And so it's not uncommon for people to be depressed in those last days. So I remember coming into a room. This gentleman was in the hospital and on a medical floor, but he was quite depressed, and this general medical doctor asked me to come in and see if I could help him. And so I come in the room, and he looks very despondent. What's going on? He said, well, I'm dying. Why shouldn't I be despondent? It's all over. And he had some form of cancer. He still had some time. It wasn't like he was going to die tomorrow. But he just learned that he had a form of cancer that was going to end his life in the next 6 months, next year. But he's saying to me, it's all over. And I said, well, why are you saying that? Well, look at my room here. There's no pictures. There's no cards. Nobody's visiting me. My kids don't even know that I'm dying. I haven't had contact with them in 10 or 15 years. And I know why. I was a horrible father. Well, I wasn't exactly a horrible father, but I really wasn't there for the graduations and the football games. So because I was totally involved in the family business, and I thought I was doing the right thing, making a living and providing material for them, but I never really was there for them. And now they could care less about me. And so, you know, it's hopeless. And I said, why are you saying it's hopeless? I'm dying. So I'm saying to him, well, look, you're very much alive today. You've got lots of feelings, so you're very much alive today. Whatever time you have, and I don't know how much time you have, but what would you want to accomplish? And he was kind of taken aback by that question. And he thought for a moment and said, I would want to tell my kids I'm sorry. So I said to him, well, why don't you? You got a phone. You have some relatives who know where they are. They could act as an intermediary and let them know. Did you want to tell them that you're sorry? So I came back then to see him a couple days later, and he's markedly less depressed. He's sitting up in a chair and he's dressed. He said, you won't believe this, doctor. I get emotional on this. The two of my kids are flying in. And you could see that even though this was the last chapter of his life, and I use this analogy with him, you know, this may be the last chapter, but you're writing it. You know how you read a book, and maybe it's a long novel, and it's kind of boring, you're halfway through it. So, gee, I'm just going to put this down. I've read 200 pages, another 200 pages, I'm not going to waste my time. But he said, I've read all this, my novel. You force yourself to finish it. It turns out the last chapter puts it all together. It's the best chapter you ever, best book ever. And your life, this is a chapter. This may be the last chapter. You're writing it. And this is, you're writing a beautiful chapter. Because for you to die without letting them know how you feel really hurts them as much as it hurts you. And because they probably want to know your father. And so that's an example of a situation where most people say, well, he's got terminal illness and nothing he can do. But when you talk with him, and I just asked him, what would you want to do? And it made his last months the best months of his life.
Well, the people listening cannot see the emotional impact of what you are sharing. With me, I just want people to know that I'm not only listening to you, but I'm seeing your tears. And that's the one thing that always impressed me about you, is that you are very much passionate, compassionate, and loving with the people that you take care of. And being the medical director of a community mental health system, you're responsible for I don't know how many thousands of people who come to you. And my takeaway from all this is that today, what I'm taking away from you is that by listening to others, we come up with ways to help them by just listening and then maybe asking them one question that allows them. So is it true in psychiatry that really a psychiatrist enables somebody to look within themselves and all the answers are really there of how to help?
I think that's an excellent summary.
So opening the door for people, that's how
human beings are amazing. They just have to help them see themselves. And once you help them see themselves, inevitably they see their strengths and the things that really matter to them. To this man who was in the last stages of his life, what matters for him, what to him was to have a relationship with his children. A basic thing, but he's missing in his life. And here was a chance to restore.
But what I liked, my favorite story just that you just told was about the man in prison. That you listened to him and you found what you heard one thing that he said and you built on that. You built on that one positive message that he was just passing over. And that's the ability to listen to others and to see the goodness in them and then to build upon that. What happens when people are not able to open up and they come to you and they're very angry and feel that you sit here on the other side as a man in a suit, well-dressed, could not possibly understand their pain? Do you ever get where they say to you, you don't understand me?
And yes, it's not unusual. And so it takes patience. It's very easy as a therapist to get angry with the patient or to say, well, if he's non-compliant, I can't help him and fire him. And that was kind of the model in the past. But the other important advance we've made is something called being person-centered, people-centered. So this person is coming to me for help. I need to try and help him. He's not coming to me for me. He's coming to see me so I help him. I've got to focus on helping him. And so how do we get past what we call resistance? He's really resistant. His anger has nothing to do with me. You know, it's maybe the first time, the second time he's ever seen me. Why would he be so angry with me? There are other issues in his life that are making him angry. And if I can help him understand what those are, and if I don't react by rejecting him, by listening and being respectful of his feelings, I see your anger, your frustration. I really do want to help you, but I want to understand the level of your anger because I'm sensing that you came in here real angry. So I may have done some things to upset you, but what was happening before you walked in the door here that was making you so angry? And to really help him understand what his feelings are all about.
There's also something that makes you unique. Psychiatry today, at least my experience, is psychiatrists don't see clients anymore. That they do 15-minute prescription things. Social workers refer people to psychiatrists for medication. So you also shared with me earlier that you maintain a practice where you are always working with people.
So, you know, I always wanted to be a doctor. I think part of that came from my parents who wanted to be proud of their son. They didn't have an education. That they were laborers. They wanted their son to be a professional. And so being a doctor, particularly in my father's eyes, was sort of like the ultimate in profession. So I grew up with that image of being a doctor. But I also was very much interested in psychology and the human mind. And so becoming a psychiatrist was a perfect blend of being a physician who specializes in the mind. And so I've never given up my identity as a physician, so I prescribe medication, but I also always wanted to be a psychotherapist so that I've never, sometimes I'll see people for medication reviews. But even in that situation where it might be 15 or 20 minutes, I'm still trying to understand what's going on in that person's life beyond, well, was the medicine helping? Fine, right in the prescription. I want to know how they're doing. So I don't, you know, when someone comes through the door, whether it's for a medication review or for psychotherapy, I start out with wanting to tell me how things have been going. And I always listen. And in the process of listening, learn so much about that person. And in turn, puts me in a better position to be able to help them with the right questions. Very often it's not that I give them the answers. You know, you do these 10 things, you'll be fine. I mean, sometimes you do give advice to people, but more often than not, it's patients saying to you, what do you think? Do you think it would make sense for me to pick up the phone and call my son, even though I haven't talked to him in 10 years. And I would say, well, why wouldn't you? But I don't tell them what to do. I encourage them to find what works for them. But getting back to the question of, the economics of healthcare today is such that very often psychiatrists end up being the medication consultant and not doing psychotherapy. But I don't like to limit my practice to simply giving medication. Medications can be very helpful in severe illness, but it's never enough. It always has to be psychotherapy accompanying it to have the optimal outcome.
Now, what do you see as your biggest reward working on a scale so large, a whole county, and managing?
The greatest reward, well, first of all, working with other people together to come to put together programs and strategies to help large numbers of people. So one of the wonderful things that I've been able to do here, to do with a team of people, is that when I came on board, one of my assignments was to sit on what's called a central event review committee, where we review adverse outcomes, deaths, the kind of outcomes you don't want to have happen. But every week we meet, and it always would be people who died, suicide, premature death. And so what I decided was that we need to identify people who are at risk for bad outcomes and see if there's anything we can do to prevent those bad outcomes. So we initially called this our high utilizer committee. It's a bad term. High utilizer means frequent hospitalizations, frequent arrests, frequent failing to make appointments, the people who are just not working well in the system and not getting better. So we identified these people and asked that they be presented to us. We like a number of people sitting around the table. If you know Grand Rounds, where a case is presented. So we would have the doctor or social worker, whoever's taking care of this person, case manager, present the case. And there would be people from all of our core provider agencies, so 10, 15 people sitting around the table, and we would discuss the case and then have the presenter, in this case the case manager, so keep presenting the case to us until there was a measure of recovery that we all agreed on. So sometimes people would be presented to us for 6 months, a year, 2 years, but inevitably what happened is outcomes improved. And these were very challenging people. These were people who were homeless. These were people who had burned all their bridges, had no family, minimal education, were abusing drugs, people who said hopeless. And we were able to measure this because we have electronic health record now. And we could track, for example, for the 6 months before they were presented to us, they were hospitalized six times. And now, since they've been presented to us over the last few months, they've only been hospitalized once. So they're still sick. They're still hospitalized once. But once is a whole lot better than six times. And so we've been doing this now for several years. And 80% of the time when people are presented to us, their outcomes improve. Even though, when you read the charts, it's prognosis abysmal. So that's been tremendously rewarding. And you can't do that as a practitioner by yourself in an office. You have to have a team of people. You have to have IT. You have to have electronic health record. You have to be able to track, because you have to know, were they hospitalized? How do I know who's hospitalized? Well, we have ODIN, electronic health record, that tells us all of this stuff. But you need a whole team of people to keep track of all of this. And then we document it all. And we've actually been able to publish results in journals, because this is really noteworthy stuff that we really can help people. Nobody thinks.
So I see in you the sparkle in your eye when you talk about the ability to work with others on a team to help people in the community.
Because, I remember when I first started this project, I'd sit in this room and the case manager is presenting this case. And I'd say, oh, my God, what can I say to help? This is overwhelming. But I got 10 other people around the room. We start throwing out ideas. And pretty soon we come up with a solution. Somebody says, so I asked the presenter, we don't know a lot about the early history of this person. Could you go back and talk with him or the family and find out what really happened when he was growing up, because there's a big hole in our understanding. So the therapist or the case manager comes back the next time and says, and asking and talking with the patient about the early life, it turns out that there's an uncle who lives in Louisiana who's maintained contact with, and he would want to be helpful. I said, great, let's get in touch with that uncle. He's far away, but he can keep in touch by phone or email, whatever. And that was a turning point for this patient. He was not all alone now. He had somebody out there who really cared about him, even though he was 1,000 miles away. And that was enough to motivate him to stop drinking and to, you know, find a house and not be homeless, et cetera, et cetera. So it's these little things that make a big difference. But it takes a team effort to find out. You know, when you find out what's going on, you find something that's working.
So to me, for all the problems that we have in this entire world, if people would just come with the problem, listen to each other, honor what the other person is saying, and listen carefully with the intention to find answers to the problem, not bringing in their egos and everything else. And it seems to me.
So, you know, this is, when you think about, we're talking about therapy of people with mental illness, but when we talk about relationships of people in general, or relationships between countries, or relationships between people of different religions, or whatever is pushing them apart, being able to understand each other and talk with each other greatly diminishes the likelihood that we'll hurt each other. Greatly increases the likelihood that we'll help each other. So, you know, just reading in the newspaper yesterday, that India and China are near war because of a dispute over 3 miles of where the border's on this side and this side, and the army's on either side. And all it takes is somebody shooting a gun and 100 people are going to be killed. When if they could sit down and talk, it's a lousy 3 miles. It's going to hide up in half. Whatever. We don't have to kill each other on this. But that won't happen unless there's an emotional connection between the people about. So that I can't hurt you if I know you. Because as human beings, we have a natural love for each other. We respect life. We cherish it. But only if we're close enough to feel it, to experience it. And so that's a very important part of helping people, because when a patient knows that you really care about them, now that can be very motivating, because very often in their lives they felt that nobody really cared.
So Dr. Leonard Rosen, I thank you for taking an hour to speak to us today, and I wish you all the best in your practice.
Thank you.
On behalf of Integrity in Action, we want to thank you for listening to Integrity in Action with Lois Shulman. Join us monthly for the fourth Friday of the month from 7 to 8 p.m. For more information on guests, your host, Lois Shulman, please visit BodyMindSpiritRadio.com and visit the Integrity in Action show page. And until next time, good night.